Welcome to Beneath Your Beautiful, where guests share stories of adversity and perseverance, which inspire, encourage, and challenge us. We embrace these tough conversations, intimately exploring our loves, fears, and hopes with a delicious combination of depth and lightness.
Hi, I'm Rose Bax, and I'm thrilled to be with you today. I am a professional benefit and fundraising auctioneer by trade, but my joy really is wrapped up in my kiddos, which I have three of, and my husband, and just doing our best every day to try to share a little bit of joy and love and just peace with the people around us.
I have so many questions already. Like, do auctioneers really say stuff?
We really do say stuff. Yes.
What are you saying?
Everybody has a different thing that they say. The technical terminology is called filler words. Those are our filler words. And everybody says something different. So my filler words usually are very simple, and it's just dollar. So whatever the dollar is I'm asking, and then bidder now, dollar bidder now, $100 bidder now, $200 bidder now, $300 bidder now. Other auctioneers that are more talented than me can use all sorts of different filler words, call people by name, recite poetry. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, wow. I didn't know there was an art to it.
Yes, very much so.
Is that to generate excitement and a sense of urgency?
That is exactly what it's for. We talk a lot about the kind of like the early foundations of auction industry was to make a rapid sale. And so that's really the purpose of the chant, is just for the rhythm to go from one item to the next item to the next item, and from one price to the next price to the next price in rapid succession.
Did you have to get trained for that?
My husband is actually a second generation auctioneer, and he started selling, did his first auction when he was only 14. When he and I met, he was already an auctioneer in the auction business. And then I kind of followed in his footsteps into the business. And I did go to auctioneer school in Auburn, Indiana, gosh, 24 years ago now, a long time ago. I was fortunate when I first started doing benefit and fundraising events specifically, that I worked with a company that was actually based in Seattle, and they sent me all over the country doing benefit and fundraising events in communities, you know, in California and Florida. And so I had just a great experience traveling around the country and meeting people. And so it was really eye-opening. I learned a tremendous amount about just the auction, fundraising auction industry as a whole. And then when my kiddos, my first daughter was born, I came off the road. She's 11. So I came off the road and came home and started just being here full time. And so I do benefit and fundraising events in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene. Well, I mean, surrounding areas. And then also I sell cars out at Dealer's Auto Auction every Thursday. I'm an auto auctioneer. And I've been super blessed to have enough work to keep me busy and build a place for my kids to come along with. Our three kiddos actually join us sometimes and work alongside of us. My 11-year-old is incredibly articulate and smart. And so she has co-hosted alongside, and she's been my, you know, MC at auctions. And my two littles are bid spotters at 9 and 7, or maybe showcasing some of the items. They work alongside of us. And so that's actually been super fun too. I grew up in rural North Idaho on a farm with my family. And I have 5 siblings.
Oh, I do too. I'm the youngest of 6.
I have 3 older brothers and 2 younger sisters.
Oh, there's 3 and 3. That's 2. That's cool.
And they're awesome. My siblings are pretty rad. I think they're some of the coolest people I know. And so we grew up on a farm, and, you know, we worked hard, and, you know, we tried to do some extracurriculars and those types of things. As there were less and less kids in the house, there were more and more opportunities for extracurriculars. So, you know, my brothers never did a lot, but my sisters and I, we were softball players. And one of the things that I remember about my childhood was, again, we worked hard. My mom always grew a pretty substantial garden that we picked and plucked and, you know, picked rocks and snapped peas and helped with the canning. And my dad was a hunter, and he took my brothers hunting, and then we helped cut and wrap. And then there was the pigs, with lots of pigs and chickens. And so we gathered the eggs and we fed the animals. And then we harvested the chickens too. We never harvested the pigs. We always had a butcher come and do that. But, you know, I remember lots of days of my mom literally wringing necks. My mom would grab the chicken by the head and spin its body off crazy. And then we would, you know, dunk and pluck and all that stuff. So that was childhood for us. We worked and we never have ever been afraid of just plugging along. You had to. It was part of the process was that we did it together. We didn't have a lot. My dad, you know, there were six of us. My dad worked and my mom didn't for most of our lives. And I remember I was such a nerd and we got picked on. You know, now it's so cool. I love that it's cool to go thrifting. It's, you know, the more clothes you can buy at UGM and at, you know, St. Vinny's and Value Village. I mean, it's cool. But when I was a kid, that was not cool.
Right.
And my mom was, she was, you know, we did St. Vinny's. That was our go-to shop, the St. Vinny's. And I remember one time when I walked onto the playground when I was maybe in third or fourth grade and I, you know, had just gotten to school. And I remember getting off the school bus and I was wearing this pink t-shirt and I still remember the shirt. And there was a girl that was on the playground and she actually ran up to me and knocked me down and said, "That's my shirt. I just donated it to St. Vinny's yesterday. It probably has my name on the tag." And she knocked me down on the ground and like pulled the tag up from the back of my shirt. And I just remember thinking, "Oh, please God, please don't let her name be on the back of the shirt," you know? And it wasn't. It could have been because undoubtedly my mom had just purchased the shirt at St. Vinny's. And I just remembered, you know, in that moment, I couldn't have known. But now I actually think about that little girl a lot. And it just gives me so much, I guess, empathy for the people that find themselves. And it's so silly what we put value in. And that girl is actually still not in my life a lot, but her family is still part of my life. And she probably, I would bet to this day, has no memory of having done that thing to me.
If she does remember it, she didn't think anything of it.
Yeah, she probably has no idea the impact that it actually had on me. But then there was beautiful things too. I had a bus driver. Her name was Marge and she was so wonderful. And she had a couple of older daughters that were older than my sisters and I. My sisters are twins and they're 18 months younger than me. And so we rode the bus and we were the first people on the bus and the last people off the bus. And so Marge would bring clothes and she would stuff them behind the very back seat of the bus. And then when we would get off the bus, the very last stop, she would put the bus in park and she would say, "Wait, girls, I have something for you," and go to the back of the bus and bring out this bag of clothes. And so it's silly because we still put so much value on what we wear, how we look. So it's not lost on me that these kind of monumental impacts in my life both had to do with clothing and appearance and the way we look to others. You know, this one girl kind of beats me up and makes fun of me and, you know, really diminishes me as a human over my clothes. And then this other person really invested and valued me and made me feel confident in the clothes that she gave. And I remember my sisters and I would kind of a long driveway and we'd throw that bag. It was a plastic trash bag, throw that bag over our shoulders and run up the driveway and then go into our bedroom and, you know, shake those clothes out all over the floor. And just, it was like Christmas, you know, we loved it. And I think that's actually part of the reason that it's easy for me to be passionate about supporting others. You know, someone showed up for me in that way. It made such an impact on me that it's easy for me to want to encourage other people to show up like that for someone else. My parents got divorced when I was 12. And so my two younger sisters and I, we stayed with my dad, which was really atypical of divorced environments during that time. And so, you know, I grew up really quick at 12. I took over really, I was like the woman of the house. You know, I prepared the meals and washed the laundry and did all of those things. And it just was the nature of what happened in that duration of my life. And when my husband and I got married, I was so opposed to preparing a meal. I didn't want anything to do with it. I didn't want to cook. And if I did cook, it was going to be really minimal because I felt like I had done so. I couldn't process it in my mind at the time But I think it was really this aversion to having been forced into that role at such a young age. I mean, it's fine. You can cook meals. It wasn't like I'm not trying to make it sound like having to cook a meal at 12 was some sort of tragic thing, but it was, yeah. By the time I was an adult and married, I was like, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm so done with preparing meals.
Yeah.
And I didn't really learn to love cooking and the idea of creating a healthy, nurturing meal until I had kids. And that wasn't that long ago, 11 years ago. I finally felt like, okay, I can adult through this now.
Totally understand how something can happen in your younger years and it affect the rest of your life.
One time, this is a funny story I'll tell about my dad. We needed pads, maxi pads. And my dad had gone to the store and he was working a night shift. And so he got home in the middle of the night and we were all asleep. And I got up the next morning to find Depends on the kitchen table at home. And I remember telling my dad, Dad, it's a menstrual cycle, not incontinence, you know? And he was like, well, I need more specifics. And so writing the grocery list or that, you know, that list for my dad, that was like always plus with wings on the blue bag with the yellow, you know, he had to go to all of the details for my poor dad as he's trying to navigate three teenage daughters as a single dad. So
why did you go with your dad?
My mom chose it. She was moving on to, it was a challenging time for her and her life. And she had gotten remarried and had moved just in an environment where there wasn't space. It wasn't a safe space for us to be. And so it was her choosing. There wasn't necessarily a battle or anything like that. There was never going to be any other way. Our kids leave a pretty charmed life, really, all things considered. My dad actually just passed this year. It was hard. It was a quick pass. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor and about 7 weeks later, he passed. But we had the 7 weeks. I can't say enough about forgiveness and reconciliation. And, you know, I think every childhood is challenging. Our kids, my husband and I, you know, our kids leave a pretty charmed life, really, all things considered. But I can see the things I say that hurt them. I mean, even just this morning, trying to get my daughter ready for school and we were battling over shoes. And, you know, here I'm just trying to rush her out the door to get her to school. And I'm harsh and aggressive. And there's tears, you know, running down the face of my 9-year-old. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, was it worth it? Like, was my speed up, was my pressure? And then, though that's the constant conflict, I think, was my pressuring, pushing her to go, was it worth it? Or should I have just been more patient? But then the challenge is if I don't push, then we'll be here till 10 and we'll never make it to school. And so it's this constant state of, I don't know, that man, raising kids is hard. It's so hard.
Raising kids is hard. Being a mom is so hard. And the more I mommed, my kids are 28, 24. Oh boy, not only did I forgive my mother, but I don't think there's anything to forgive her for anymore because she did it with 6 kids and I struggled with 2. No matter what, your kids are mad at you. My daughter was young and she tried soccer and she was miserable. 5 years old or something. She was just like, nope, hate it, not going back. And of course I didn't make her, but she's still mad at me to this day. She's 24. She's like, you should have made me. I'm like, you try making a little kid do something they don't want to do. So no matter what, if I had forced her, she'd be mad. If I didn't force her, she's mad.
Right.
So I just don't know about the parenting thing. It's so frustrating because we try so hard. I mean, of course you're trying and you love your daughter and you want the best for her, but there's also, you have to be responsible for her.
Right. We actually have those conversations. My responsibility is to raise a human that is going to be an adult one day. And so, yes, I understand that right now in this moment, you're 9. But one day you're going to be 29. And when you're 29, I need to know that we've instilled something in you at 9 that's going to help you manage the hard things and the challenges. And the, you know, we have this, I don't want to. Well, I don't want to either. If nobody ever did the things they didn't want to do, nothing would ever get done.
That's what I say. You have one job. That's go to school. Like, you have to do it. I don't know what to tell you. I have a job. I don't want to go to it either.
It's been an interesting road to be in a business like the auction business that is so male dominated, and to come into the business as the spouse of a really well-respected and incredibly talented auctioneer has been really interesting in the 20 years that we've been doing this. It's been all over the board. One time we were doing an auction and we were traveled with a crew, a whole team of auctioneers down to California. And we were doing this huge, it was a real estate auction. And there were probably at least 10 auctioneers on the team. And I was the only woman. And we had this meeting in the lobby. And as I walked into the lobby, I hear a couple of the guys running through the list of the auctioneers that are going to be part of the team. Paul, down the list, Brian, Bax's wife. Like I didn't even have a name. I was just Bax's wife. It's actually a name I wear so honorably. I love being Bax's wife. I love my husband, and we've been married for almost 26 years, and it's an honor to be his wife, but it's been an interesting journey in the business to come alongside and, you know, have his own reputation that has undoubtedly opened doors for me, undoubtedly. But at the same time has, in the early years, kind of put a shadow over my own ability being the wife of someone who's really great. I think a lot of times people felt like they made a way. And I would say, you know, yes, my husband is the one that opened the door for me, but it was my responsibility to keep it open. So I don't care what you think right now. If at the end of the day, you still feel like I'm Bax's wife, and I typically didn't shy away from it. Middle child, 3 older brothers, 2 younger sisters, grew up on a farm. I can advocate for myself pretty well. I like to kind of hit that stuff head on. Like, if you don't think that I belong here at the end of the day, then we can have that conversation. But for now, my name's Rose. It's nice to meet you.
Oh, I really love that.
I've been in the auction business for a long time. And when I first got started, I worked on the back end. You know, I did check in and check out. I did a lot of auction setup, worked with the promotion, the advertising. And it was years after that, that I actually got up on a stage and started as the auctioneer. And I remember walking into an event and I had a great person alongside me, and his name was Larry, and Larry is a wonderful man. And I walked up to this gentleman at this fundraising event, and he reaches his hand out to Larry to shake his hand. And he said, "You must be the auctioneer." And Larry goes, no, she's the auctioneer. The man says, "Oh, I didn't realize women could do that." And I said, "Well, I mean, I don't have any physical limitations that would prevent me from being able to do this." And so there has been a lot of that. When I decided I wanted to become an automobile auctioneer, I had a gentleman come to me and say, "Nobody will listen to your voice all day. Nobody wants to listen to a woman's voice all day." I feel really fortunate, especially in the benefit and fundraising world, that women are, there's no diminished sense anymore. And in my lifetime, it's been beautiful to watch that transition happen. But one of the things I remember about my career, specifically in becoming confident in who I was that because I had heard so much about how there's no space for you, you're riding on Matt's coattails, you know, nobody wants a woman. It was frequent that somebody would say to me, "You're not going to make it. There's no space for you." And so this company that I worked for out of Seattle, they were so wonderful. And when you would get your assignment or your schedule, on the schedule, it would tell you who had been the auctioneer at that event the previous year. And so, you know, you'd be working with an organization out of Tampa, let's say you're on your way to Florida. And on that sheet, you know, the information as you're in preparation of your event, you would always know who you were following. There were certain people that I knew I had to follow that were so intimidating to me. I can't believe I have to take the stage. And I would do my best to try to mimic them or to think in my head, what is something that they do that's so great? And undoubtedly in those situations, I would fail. Mm-hmm. I would walk into that space and I would say, you know, last year's auctioneer in this spot was Jimmy. Jimmy is a bigger than life. He's just this, I mean, I watched him one time sing the national anthem to fill time, you know, and it's like, how do you follow Jimmy? And so I would try to do things that would make that happen. And undoubtedly in my effort to try to be Jimmy, I couldn't be Rose and I would fail. And it took a long time for me to realize that the only way to follow Jimmy or to follow Chuck or to follow anybody was to just be me. What I brought to the table was largely different than what any of those people could bring to the table. And so as I learned to navigate who I was in these environments where I obviously didn't belong, first I had to convince myself, but you do belong. You have all the tools. You have this whole lifetime of experience that when you get on the stage, you get to advocate for these people. When I'm selling the opportunity to build a closet inside of a school so that kids that need clothes can just go get them discreetly without having to bring any attention to themselves, that speaks to me. That is my life. I belong in this place right now advocating. I don't need to pretend like I'm somebody else in that spot because what I bring to the table is something of substance and value. And so it was a long time before I felt really comfortable in my own shoes and my own skin to be able to do that. And so now I can't imagine having done anything else. My vision and my goal was to end up in the medical field one day and to be here in this place where I get to literally get to stand on a stage and encourage people and advocate for nonprofits, for folks to rally around them is so incredible. It's such a gift. And one of the best things about what I do is that oftentimes when I'm in a room, it's this great coming together. Nonprofits are going to save the world. You know, if you go into a room, let's use the Humane Society as an example. You know, they have an incredible event, the Fur Ball every year in November, and it's packed, you know, wall to wall with people. And beyond the shadow of a doubt, there are people in that space who outside of that room would not have any sort of relationship with one another. They don't match up on their ideology. They're definitely not matching up on politics. They don't have the same, you know, family structures. But in this place right now, we've come together to support this organization that we both love. Well, there are so many wonderful examples of nonprofits that are bridging the gap, and they're helping to kind of calm the narrative about how divided we are. Because in any given fundraising environment, there are people on both sides of any political spectrum, any, you know, opinion about, you name it. There's opposing opinions in those spaces, but they can come together because they want to make sure that kids have access to quality healthcare or that it's easy to support organizations that fund education. I think that's one of the best things about doing what we do and kind of at the heart of it all. I love that there have been multiple times that I have considered quitting. Really considered, like, he's right. You know, this organization, they're right. They didn't like me. I'm not fit for them. They're right. I don't have a space here. And then I would get a wonderful text message or a phone call or an anonymous card in the mail that just would encourage me to get back up and go again. And so I don't know what I would do otherwise. And I don't know how I ended up here. But I'm thankful. The journey has been beautiful and hard and so hard, but beautiful.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Beneath Your Beautiful, hosted by Hara Allison. And thank you for your ratings and reviews. We'll be back next week with a new episode. Stay tuned.